compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning and welcome back. Hey, Cyrus, welcome back to you. You've been gone for over a week now, my friends. Good to have you back.
It is good to be back, sir.
Yeah, I hope you had a great time. Took a little R&R with the family. That's always good.
Yeah, we could call it that. Sure.
That's what we'll call it.
But it is really good to be back, on the show. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we'll have you back anytime. Yeah, your fans were clamoring for you, by the way. So it's good to have you back, Cyrus. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. 888-914-9149. We have plenty to talk about today. So much so that I'm not sure if we'll be able to get to all of this. I'd like to start with a little tidbit from your home state of Oregon, Cyrus.
Oregon.
you know, you can always tell somebody who's not from Nevada because they say Nevada. Just FYI.
Nobody says that.
They do. Oh, yeah, all the time. People say Nevada, but it's Nevada. Anyway, so this is from Beaverton, Oregon. And it has to do with the Beaverton School District, or BSD for short, or BS District, whichever way you want to shorten it. The Beaverton School District has issued some information. They call it an Equitable Policies Board Report. The draft is what's circulating right now, in which they declare themselves to be white supremacists. This is an article by Georgia Howe on the Daily Wire. In the second paragraph of the Equitable Policies Board Report draft, which members will pass, they expect it's going to pass. And by the writing of this article, it may already have passed. But she says that the task force affirms unabashedly that Beaverton School District perpetuates institutional racism and embodies a white supremacist culture. The same school district that also endorsed a blacks-only graduation event, which, by the way, according to the article, did not even require graduates to meet the normal qualifications for graduation. So there's some problems going on at the school district. She points out at various points in the statement, it says it is going to confront and eliminate all forms of conscious and even unconscious racism and bias in Beaverton, all of which are good goals, if you ask me. I certainly endorse those goals. Let's get rid of racism. The only problem is that it devolves into a kind of form of racism against white people by insisting that by being white, they are inherently racist. Some of the comments were interesting to read. One person pointed out that the one-page vision statement was very thoughtful and inspiring. I feel like this captures everything we've been working on the past few months. I'm sure it does. Another person had a concern about this and said, I'm not a fan of the term people of color. I'm uncomfortable with it, and I feel like every time it is used, it diminishes me. I would hope we could find another way to say non-white. One member demonstrated some prescience, voicing concerns about declaring themselves white supremacists. He or she stated, while I agree with the term and how it's used, I'm concerned about spending unnecessary energy defending this one word. I think that's a good point. For Beaverton parents who naively believe that academics will remain fundamental to the school's school district's mission, they should refer to this quote, which says, and this is from the statement, eliminating racism in all forms of bias is fundamental to our work. It's not just part of our work. I would think that education would be fundamental to the work. One father who is a Latino, and he, being a father of three kids, he's invested in the school district. His name is Joshua Guerra. You like how I pronounce that, Cyrus? When you have a double R, you have to trill the R. Guerra.
You might not be surprised. I cannot do that.
Give it a try.
No.
G-U-E-R-R-A.
I can't do it. I cannot roll my R's.
Guerra.
Nope.
Guerra. Oh, you just did it. You did it.
Okay, thanks.
Try it again.
No, that was once all you get.
I'll give you an easy one.
Back to the story.
Madrid. Yeah. You really can't do it.
I really can't. Okay.
Back to the story. So if we dropped you off in downtown Madrid, Spain, you're not going to get very far is what you're saying, right?
No, I'm embarrassed now.
Right. Welcome back, Cyrus.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
Oh, what did we do without you? I don't know, but man. I mean, hey, Jim did a great job. And Jake did a great job.
Yeah,
and
thanks to all those guys for
all those guys who filled in
really
for you.
They really helped out a lot.
Yeah, but they can trill their R's. Just FYI, they can do that. So, okay, let me just read to you, and I'll leave it at this. This is what this Latino father of three, Joshua Guerra, said about this. He said, the language and phrases used in this statement are alarming, irresponsible, unfounded, and divisive. The statement contains radical presuppositions about the apparent structural racism and perpetuation of a white supremacist culture. These terms, when used in this context, are insulting to entire demographic groups within our community and further perpetuate a radical racialization of our community members. The statement continues by committing to, quote, dismantle policies and systems that perpetuate white supremacy, end quote. Yet it fails to identify what policies and or systems within the district actually perform this function or how the act of dismantling will be carried out. The statement further commits to ongoing anti-bias and anti-racist education to every staff member. In this statement alone, one can infer that anti-bias trainings, which are offered by diversity, equity, and inclusivity consultants, will be based on critical social justice pedagogy. The vocabulary used in the overall statement is indicative of the ideological underpinnings of critical theory, applied postmodernism, and intersectionality. In particular, this dad says, trainings by many, not all, DEI consultants include tests which purport to measure bias of individuals and are based on the implicit bias, implicit association test. However, there is considerable debate and doubt in the psychological community about the application of implicit bias testing and what it actually measures about individuals. In short, the commercial use of the IAT on staff and faculty is not scientifically rigorous and should be regarded with extreme caution. Other radical and racialized practices of DEI training have been known to use racial and gender segregation as a training method, along with racial essentialism, the primacy of power dynamics, a victim and oppressor privileged narrative, and a structural racial determinism. Perhaps most alarming, he says, given the BSD is concerned with education, is the notion in critical theory that standpoint epistemology, or more commonly referred to as lived experience, I kind of like the standpoint epistemology way of saying it better. Cyrus, what's your standpoint epistemology of tacos?
So are you going to finish this?
It's almost done. I've got, you can hardly wait, can't you? So let's see. The blah, 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 blah. This is all really good, by the way. Is the notion in critical theory that standpoint epistemology, or more commonly referred to as lived experience, is a more robust form of truth than objective truth or empirical data. So how do you answer for this, Cyrus? That's your home state. What is your...
I just don't understand. I don't understand any of it. It does not make any sense to me. Mm-hmm. So the school wants to call themselves white supremacist, is that...
They're saying that about themselves.
You know, if my school that I was sending my kids to came out and said, yeah, we're white supremacists, my kids would no longer go to that school.
Right. Or can I offer an alternative? If you, the superintendent or the principal or what have you, say that, then okay, you're fired. Because we don't want racists.
I don't want to be around racists. I don't want my kids to be taught by racists.
Right. I'm with you. I'm 100% like on that.
None of this makes any sense.
And that's the whole point of it, really. And that's why I wanted to kind of point out some of these real-world examples. You know, it's my standpoint epistemology, after all, to point these things out, is because it is so inherently ridiculous. And it is inherently racist to go around saying that everybody is inherently racist by judging groups of people on the basis of their skin color. It's inherently racist. It's a form of bias. It's ugly.
And it perpetuates racism.
Exactly.
Yeah, this is a no-brainer.
I think. I do too. But you know what, Cyrus, and you've seen this too on social media, there are people out there for whom this is kind of like their new religion now. And if anybody dares to criticize critical race theory and some of the other parallel theories that are advancing in lockstep with this, you are deemed to be a racist on the face of it simply because you disagree with this ideology.
Oh yeah, I'm therefore a racist no matter what because I'm white.
So they say.
Right.
And we know it's not true. But unless enough people start standing up and saying it's not true, then this will continue to steamroll. It's going to just continue to steamroll. And
that is what it looks like is happening right now.
Yeah.
Really
that
does.
Is so true. Well, I'd like to, as an addendum to that, I'd like to share some thoughts about this topic by Dennis Prager. He's a commentator. And he has a very interesting article here. It's in PJ Media. If America is racist, why have millions of blacks immigrated here? Did Jews immigrate to Germany in the 1930s? And he, by the way, is Jewish. So here's what he says. If America is systemically racist, why have millions of blacks from Africa and the Caribbean come to this country over the past 50 years? Good, honest question. Why would they and many millions more want to move from all black societies to a white-dominated racist one? This is a question every black and white leftist should be asked. After all, no Jews moved to Germany in the 1930s, and why didn't any? After all, many Jews were suffering terrible persecution and poverty in Russia and in Eastern Europe. Why didn't any of them move to Germany after 1933? We all know the answer, because Germany was systemically anti-Semitic. Even leftists know that answer. So one can only conclude that in the view of America's leftists, non-German Jews of the 1930s had the wisdom not to move to Germany, but present-day non-American blacks have no wisdom. In the view of America's leftists, then, the millions of blacks who have moved here and the many millions who want to move here must be fools. Now, please understand what he's saying here. He doesn't believe that. I certainly don't believe that. But he's saying that's the natural result of this notion that because allegedly, anyway, purportedly, the United States is an inherently racist country, why would all of these black people be moving here if that's in fact really what was going on? And the only conclusion one could reasonably draw would be they must be fools. And they're not. That's the whole point of this. So let's continue. Dennis Prager says, how else could leftists regard blacks who willingly move to America? Any black person who decides to leave a black country for America, a place the left claims was founded by racists to perpetuate racism, built and sustained by racism, to this day composed largely of whites, every one of whom is racist, and many of whom are white supremacists and therefore remain systemically racist, must either be a fool or an ignoramus or both. Again, he doesn't believe that they are. I don't believe that they are. But what other conclusion do you draw when you see so many millions and millions of black people from different parts of the world coming to the United States? If so-called black leaders and other blacks on the left and white progressives believe what they say about America, why aren't they doing everything they can to dissuade blacks in Africa and Caribbean and the Caribbean from coming to America? Why aren't they regularly visiting African and Caribbean countries to warn Africans away from the black-hating country they are thinking of emigrating to? To this question, there is only one possible answer. They don't believe what they say about America. Whether leftists believe their lies is a question I have pondered for years. Now, this is Dennis Prager speaking. I'm just simply sharing with you this article. It's not very long. Whether they believe their lies, he says, the leftists, I have pondered for years, and I have concluded that in general they do. Most leftists believe that Russia colluded with the Trump campaign, that men menstruate and give birth, that Shakespeare and Beethoven are revered not because they are great but because they are white. The global warming is an existential threat, that the events of January 6th were an insurrection. He goes through a list of these things, and they're all controversial in their own way. But he says, but with regard to their believing America is systemically racist and so persecutes black people, LeBron James tweets that, like all blacks, quote, we're literally hunted every day, every time we step foot outside the comfort of our homes. He's quoting LeBron James, something that he said on Twitter. Oprah Winfrey says that the current United States of America is like the days of Jim Crow, when black men would be lynched and dragged through the town as an example for other people to see. Prager says they're not making any attempt to dissuade blacks from coming to America. That they're not making any attempt to dissuade black people from coming to America makes no sense. It only makes sense if they don't believe what they say about America. He says, truth has never been a left-wing value. Truth is a liberal value, and it is a conservative value, but it has never been a left-wing value. Truth is nothing more than whatever the left says it is at any given moment. That is why Lenin, the father of modern leftism, named the Soviet Communist Party newspaper Pravda, the Russian word for truth. Truth was what the Soviet Communist Party said it was. For Lenin, then, as for Representative Adam Schiff, the New York Times, Yale University, and CNN Today, truth is what they say it is. Their Pravda is that America is a systemically racist country. Their Pravda is that all whites are racist. And he goes down the list of these things. He's making a very good point. And I never had thought about that myself when you consider the immigration numbers of so many people from all different backgrounds, all different countries trying to get into the United States, you know, making their visa application and such. Why would they do that if indeed America were really as terrible and as systemically racist as some people would like you to believe? I think he's got a good point. And we'll post it on the show Twitter feed. Cyrus, you're still doing that these days, aren't you?
I'm a little rusty, but I just got it up.
What? So it's amazing.
It's there
what
right now.
10 days of sun or fun in the sun will do. To
I think you're painting an inaccurate picture of what I was up to.
Oh, well, you know.
But that's fine.
That's what I'd like to think that you were up to.
Hey, I'm just glad to be back on Taco Tuesday.
I know. Oh, that's right. How can I forget Taco Tuesday?
Very excited.
So I have a question for you, Cyrus. Do you? No, this is
a serious question.
It is a serious question. Okay. Do you drink energy drinks?
No.
Like Monster?
No, I do not. I have had one before. I actually drank two, like back to back, and it just wrecked my stomach. It was awful.
Oh, really?
I did not like it at all. I was like, no thanks. And so, I poured out the last bit of it. It was in a can, and I poured it out, and it was like this neon green, and I'm pretty sure it glows in the dark.
So probably like
it is not a natural color.
Like radiator fluid or something like
that's
that.
That's exactly what it looked like. That's exactly probably what it was.
Well, I'm happy for you that you don't drink it. Do your kids ever want to drink energy drinks?
Yeah, my 15-year-old, he's like, oh, he had one just the other day, and I was like, oh, what are you drinking that for? He's like, oh, it's really good. No, it's not.
All the kids are doing it, Dad.
Yep.
Well, you probably will be very interested in this one. A heart attack survivor who had 12 energy drinks a day aims to ban sales to kids. That's from the New York Post. A man who once downed a dozen energy drinks a day is warning parents to be sure that their kids avoid these dangerous beverages. His name is Lee Kamen, 55 years old. He has embarked on a campaign for kids' health after discovering that his daughter, Summer, who's 10, had managed to purchase a Monster energy drink at a convenience store next to her elementary school. Kamen was once known to consume 8 to 12 energy drinks a day. Can't even imagine. He's the owner of the Vault Bar in Hull, the UK. He said that his demanding work led him to drink the energy-boosting beverages constantly to keep me going. He said, I would buy cases of 24 cans and just drink them like any other drink. His brands of choice were Red Bull and Monster. He did this for about a year until he suffered a near-fatal heart attack. This is in 2017. And that's when he said, I'm done. I'm not going to drink this anymore. He said, one day I collapsed with a heart attack and had to have a stent fitted. I am now on medication for life due to those dangerous drinks. So when he discovered that his daughter had been able to purchase the very same beverage that had nearly claimed his life, next to a school, no less, he said he took it straight off her and poured it straight down the drain.
Good.
Kind of like
him.
What you did, Cyrus. Yeah.
Good dad.
Give me that.
You know, one of my really good friends just texted me and said, my doctor calls energy drinks strokes in a can.
Oh, my.
Yeah, stay away from that stuff.
So now I've never, okay, this is true. I've never had one. I know that my young adult kids, they like them, they drink them. I've never seen them drink more than one. I can't imagine anyone drinking 12, but what is in it? Is it just hepped up on caffeine? What all is in these drinks?
They're all artificial chemicals. I don't think there's a, if you try to read the ingredients on the side, I doubt you'll know what any of them is.
Yeah, it's all the technical terms for these different substances. Well, thankfully, this article does give some of those details here. First, a little bit. Let's see. So I'm just looking at how he is running his campaign to help people get off the energy drinks. He points out that according to the American Heart Association, even in young people and otherwise healthy adults, just one drink is enough to bring on a heart arrhythmia. Other studies have suggested that energy drinks can become a gateway to other stimulants, including cocaine. Adolescents ages 12 to 18 should have no more than 100 milligrams per day of caffeine, the amount contained in about one 12-ounce can of Red Bull. This is according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. Many of those drinks are packed with as much sugar as a soda of the equivalent size. So there's another ingredient. He says that the shop shouldn't be selling these to kids. I guess they really should treat them the way they would treat cigarettes or alcohol.
I don't think that's too much to ask.
I really don't either.
And because, especially, I mean, a 7-Eleven or some little convenience store right next to a school.
Especially? I thought that the time off would do you good. Okay. Saved by the bell, Cyrus. Thank you. Yeah, energy drinks. Check out that article. Cyrus will have it posted for you on the show Twitter feed, which you can access at the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Check it out. I'll be right back with more, with Cyrus too, with more on Taco Tuesday on the Patrick Madrid Show.
And beans on the plato. I like to eat, homie. Yo no estoy flaco. Yeah, I'm chubby, pero I'm still guapo. Uno, dos, tres.
Patrick Madrid is on
Taco Tuesday,
coast to coast on Relevant Radio.
Taco Tuesday's my favorite day.
You played this first, Cyrus. This is good.
I was too excited not to get to it.
I'm just trying to eat another plate.
Another one. Taco Tuesday. It's an institution. All right. It's got me thinking about lunch already. Let's go to the phones. 888-914-9149 is the number. 888-914-9149. Let's start in Miami with Elsie. Good morning, Elsie. Welcome.
Yes. Morning, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I am seriously concerned about, you know, all this guilty feeling that is being created here in this country. And I've been watching this for years. I lived in New Jersey. I saw that. Now I am in Miami. I'm seeing the same thing again, that we are racist. We are racist. We are racist. Mm-hmm. And the kids, they are swallowing this. And no filter, no nothing. And I just want to know which country in the whole wide world has the same amount of black people holding key positions in the different aspects of the life of a country. Here we have important black people in sports, politics, medicine, unions, school boards. How long do we have to take this? For how long? And I am sorry for people who are Democrats, but after two terms with President Barack Obama, I even had to take a picture of Michelle Obama. She was the
Let's stop right there because that's not going to be helpful for us to get into individual personalities. And let's try to stay away from politics if we can. Your point is a good one. So let's not make it less accessible to people who may not have the same political views that you do. So let's go back to your earlier point. You're asking a rhetorical question. What other country has as many black people in positions of power and influence, I think is how you put it. That's a very good question to ask. Now, I don't know. I mean, I presume, of course, if you consider the African countries, that they would have far more black people in positions of power because the populations there are far more predominantly black. So excluding those kinds of countries, if your question is centering on, like, what other countries where you have a predominantly white majority of people in that population, what other country compares with the United States when it comes to how many men and women are in positions of power and influence in the media, in music, in sports, in you name it, politics? And I think that's a very fair question to ask. I only have anecdotal information, but based upon the anecdotal information that I see, I would say that the United States is unique in that regard. I can't think of another country, certainly not in Western Europe, where you've got such a preponderance of black people who are in positions of power and authority, which I think is a good thing. So to your point, when you ask that question to other people, what kind of answers do you get? Or do you just get blank stares, Elsie?
Actually, whenever I hear these comments, I just keep quiet because I know deep inside people know that it's not true and that this is harming this country. That's the sad part of it.
Yeah.
People who are, you know, constantly talking. And, well, just put it in prayer and just ask for God to have mercy on this nation because this is not leading to anything good. So thank you for taking my call.
You're Bye-bye. Most welcome. Thank you, Elsa. Good to chat with you. Bye. Now, there's something to be that we should revisit just briefly, and that is, as others have pointed out, that this is simply a retread of Marxism. The Marxist theory, the social theory behind the economic theory, is that you've got basically two groups of people. You've got those with the money, so that would be the elites, to use a popular term nowadays, the bourgeoisie, the middle class people who have made it and they've got some money and maybe a house in the suburbs and such. And then, of course, the wealthy people above them. And so that would be one category. And then the other category is the oppressed masses, the worker, the proletariat. And the Marxist theory, and it works very well when it gets its fangs sunk into a country, is it creates this division or fosters division, more better said, between the average working person and everyone else that he considers to have more money than he does. And it creates a sense of anger and resentment and conflict. And that's the tool that they use to overthrow the corrupt Russian imperial state and many other states besides. They use this tool because it's a way of harnessing all that energy among the people who consider themselves to be oppressed, because they've been told that they're oppressed, and some people may be oppressed, but the vast majority of them are not oppressed. But when you're told over and over again that you're oppressed and that you must rise up and overthrow the oppressor, this is just textbook Marxism, political theory, economic theory. It all goes together, and it works. And people know it works because they've seen it work before, but it really only works for the people who become the new elites. The new elites, if you consider what happened in Russia after the communist revolution, all those people who were talking about how we've got to do what's right for the worker and we've got to make sure that the proletariat is safe from all the rich people and all of their greed and all that stuff. Well, as soon as they gained positions of power, they became the new elites. They were the ones in the party office buildings. They were the ones in the Politburo. They were the ones who were able to shop at special stores reserved for them, of course. And they were the ones who didn't have to stand in long lines to get food and other essentials. That was for the people, you know, well, the people that they fought for, quote unquote, the people who needed their help in overthrowing the oppressors, well, they just simply got a new set of oppressors. And the ruling elites in the Soviet Union, they were the new oppressors, and they were the ones who had the money. And, you know, the dachas off in the forest and the nice cars and all the food that they needed. They never went cold in the winter. They always had food. They were the new elites. So they simply substituted one group of successful elite people with another group of them, and all in the name of protecting the little guy. Well, this is a parallel to that in many respects, and for good reason. We've seen what happens when you go down that road. For good reason, we have to do what we can to stop it. And the best way to do that, if you ask me, especially in these early stages, is just to stand up and talk about it. Bring it out into the open, discuss it, critique it. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Palm Springs and talk to Edding. Good morning, Edding. Welcome.
Hi, Patrick. I have two questions on the reception of the Eucharist. Okay. Now, this is the scenario of during the pandemic, our church only gave communion on the hand and with the use of tongs. So that's the only way. I got two friends who refuse to go to communion because they feel it is irreverent, and you know, that's how they feel. And they mention Maria Sima, who I guess is a mystic or had a vision of a lay minister who, when he died, his hand was burned because of giving communion on the hand. And so my question to you is, would you refuse to receive our Lord even if it's the only way, but because it's so irreverent.
Okay, that's a good question. Okay, let me start with the first one. During the height of the pandemic last year, I pointed out that there are what I see as three ways of handling that situation. One would be to refrain from receiving Holy Communion. You're not obliged to receive Holy Communion, and I offer you this for your consideration, but I have to add that I'm not in any way trying to discourage anyone ever from receiving Holy Communion, unless, of course, you're like, say, a pro-abortion politician, and you're publicly, obstinately sinning and scandalizing people in a situation like that, or other situations where you're in the state of serious sin. Obviously, don't receive Holy Communion unless you've gone to confession first. But for the average person who's not in a situation like that, who is in the state of grace and is properly disposed to receive communion, one option would be you could just simply refrain from doing so. Make a spiritual communion. Now, that's not ideal, to put it lightly, but that is a legitimate option because at Sunday Mass, you're not required by the church to receive Holy Communion. You're encouraged to do so if you're properly disposed to do so, but you're not required to do so. You're required to receive communion at least once a year, but you don't have to for the typical Sunday Mass. So that's one option. Make a spiritual communion and refrain from receiving communion. A second option would be to look for a, say, a traditional Latin Mass parish run by, say, the Fraternity of St. Peter, the FSSP, which is distinct and different from other groups who are renegades. They're breakaway groups, and they're not part of the church. Although they simulate being Catholic, they're not part of the church in any official sense. So I'm not talking about those groups, but go to where the traditional Latin Mass is celebrated. That's another option. And you're not going to find communion in the hand, and you're certainly not going to find the priest distributing Holy Communion with tongs. And generally, at least from what I understand, in those parishes or in those religious communities, they're permitted by the local bishop to do it that way. It may not be permitted in the other parishes, but they have permission to do it there. So that might be another option. Find one near you and go to Mass there. Third option would be to receive Holy Communion, even though you recognize that this is a greatly exaggerated and unnecessary measure to try to avoid people getting sick from COVID. It's an unnecessary exaggeration in the name of public safety. But knowing that you still want to receive Jesus in Holy Communion, you could simply say, Lord, you know my heart. You know that I wish it weren't this way, but it is. And the only way I can receive you in Holy Communion is to have to go along with this. So I'm going to go along with this. And I offer you my sufferings in that regard. You can do that too. And I think any of those three options are entirely viable. So since you're asking me what my opinion would be do one of those three things. So what is the second question that you asked, or that you were going to ask, rather?
A comment on the first one that you said. That the only thing is, they can't even cancel.
You know what? I have to apologize. I can't really hear you because there's a bad connection there. But I hope that that helped a little bit. Thanks for the call. Let's go now to Tina in California. Good morning, Tina. Welcome.
Good morning, Patrick. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. Happy Taco Tuesday.
Oh, thank you. Happy Taco Tuesday to you.
You're welcome.
I wanted to refer back to a caller that was talking about the energy drink.
Yeah.
I personally have had an extremely bad experience. I went on a monster kick for about 8 months. I don't know why. I just started drinking them.
Wow.
Well, I started having some illness. And I went to the doctor and found out that I am losing the liner of my bladder due to drinking all those monsters.
Good heavens.
Over those course of those months. So I would call out to our teenagers that are drinking these Red Bulls, Monsters, Rock Stars. It doesn't take long to ruin something in your body. And now I have to go through a whole litany of tests and stuff, and probably will be on medication for the rest of my life for my bladder, because of Monster.
Amazing. So let me ask you a couple questions. You said you were on a Monster kick. Did that mean daily consumption, or how many drinks per day were you doing?
Consumption, 2-3 a day.
2 or 3 a day. That's all it took.
I say to myself, because my husband finally called it to my attention of how much I was drinking. I didn't even realize it.
Wow.
And after about 7-8 months, I started having problems. And he says, I'm telling you, it's those monsters that you're sucking down. And I didn't believe him, and I kept drinking them. And then finally, my whole body just changed. And I swear it was because I chose to drink all those monsters.
Now, some people would be litigious in a situation like this, and they would bring a lawsuit against those companies for bodily harm. I'm not suggesting you do that, but, I mean, is there any fine print on the cans that say, you know, we're not responsible if you lose the lining of your bladder, or we're not responsible if you have a heart attack? Did they say anything? I haven't looked at those cans. I don't know what they say.
You know what? I never looked at them. I never looked at the ingredients. All I knew is I had one that I drank, and the caffeine in it. I'm a I have schizoaffective disorder, bipolar disorder, and I get real tired. Okay. So the monsters were helping me stay awake and get my work done around the home because I'm a stay-at-home wife.
Okay.
And I would just drink them to keep my energy level up.
It sounds like they're addictive. It sounds like once you start taking them,
you know what?
It develops a habit, right?
Yes, it is. It becomes a habit, and it's hard to break. And it took me about a month of going through like slight withdrawals of not drinking them because of all the caffeine and everything else that was in them. So it's just a really bad. I hate to say Dutch Brothers feeds Red Bull to teenagers and coffee. I refuse to go to Dutch Brothers because they do this.
I don't know what that is. Is that a store?
Dutch Brothers it's like a Starbucks.
Oh, okay.
They make coffee, they make specialty drinks, and in all their specialty drinks they use Red Bull. And all the teenagers across from the high school go there in the morning, get their drinks, and then they're buzzed for the rest of the day.
Mm-hmm. You know, my impression is that for a kid who's not old enough to buy alcohol, you know, not 21, having one of these drinks might feel a little bit more adult, like, well, I can have those, I can buy those. It's not alcohol, it's not beer, but I can drink a monster drink, and that might make them feel, you know, more, hey, where'd that taco music go, Cyrus? There we go.
Yeah, I think that it makes them feel more empowered.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because, like,
hey, I've got to run, Tina.
You know,
I've got to run. I apologize. But, hey, I really am sorry to hear that your health is suffering. I hope that you get healthy again. I really do. Thanks for calling to share. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Oh, I get it, Cyrus. You spent the last 10 days practicing the bass.
Am I better than you yet?
If this is you, then yeah, you're way better than me.
This is definitely not me.
Way better than me. I could never play bass at this like this.
Yeah, this is awesome.
It is, yeah. 888-914-9149. We're going out to Barry in Huntington Beach, California. Good morning, Barry. Welcome.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
I want to preface my call with saying I do believe any and all racism is bad and should be eliminated. And while I agree with 99% of what you say today, I disagree with the comment you made about the Oregon School District. Your okay. comment was that holding black students or African-American students to a lower academic standard is racist against white people. I believe it's racism against black people by the school district, because by holding them to lower standards, what they're essentially saying is that they are not intelligent enough to be held to normal standards or pre-established standards. Additionally, what they're doing is they're crippling them later in life. By holding them to lower standards, they are not preparing them for college entrance exams, jobs, or life in general. So it's my take that it's the district that is being racist against black people, and I will listen to your comments on whether you agree or disagree off the air.
Okay, well, you're welcome to stay on the line if you want to. We certainly will make room for you. I think you misheard me, or at least you misunderstood me. You and I are in complete agreement. And my comment was not about the test, you know, the test standards being lowered for certain racial groups. My comment about it being racist toward white people was just in general the critical race theory, and singling out groups of people, or in this case, one group of people because of their white skin, and saying, because you have white skin, therefore you are this, that, and the other. That is a form of racism, and that's what I was speaking about. I wasn't referring to the test scores when I said that. So hopefully you see that you and I are not on different pages on this issue. It is inherently racist if you say to Mexicans or black people, or, and I realize that I'm mixing nationalities with racial groups here, but you get the idea. If you say, well, we are going to lower the standards for your kind, for the people in your racial group, because, well, you know, we're not going to actually say it, but because, you know, all these disadvantages and things, therefore, we just don't think you've got what it takes to hit those higher level requirements. So we're going to lower it down for you. That is blatant racism. And it's deeply offensive. People of all skin color should be offended by that. So I'm with you on that point. If that's the point you're making, I share that view. And is there anything more you wanted to add to that, Barry?
I do. I think the best way out of poverty for any group or any person is through education, and not through lower education standards, but higher education standards. That is the best way out of any form of poverty or mm-hmm. anything that is depressing a group or a race or an individual. Education is always the answer.
I agree. I do agree. And I mean, this is not to say that we shouldn't do everything that we can to help people get, you know, to improve. We should. And I'm all in favor of programs that will do that. I realize that sometimes, you know, the word programs is upsetting for some people because they see it as money that's wasted. But it doesn't have to be wasted. If it's carried out properly, if it's effective, and we need to have programs to help people raise their test scores so they can learn more easily, let's do that. Let's not go the other direction, which is what Barry was saying, of simply lowering the test scores to accommodate, because then everybody gets a trophy and nobody is really recognized for their merit or their hard work or their talent. They're just simply all given a trophy at whatever level that they may be. And I can tell you one thing, that's not what they're doing in China. That's not what they're doing in Russia. It's not what they're doing in practically anywhere else in the world. And yet we're self-imploding here because of these nonsensical policies. Barry, thank you. I'm glad to know that you and I are in agreement on this issue. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. 888-914-9149. A few other things I want to share with you. This is, I think, big news out of California. It strikes me as pandering on the part of Governor Newsom, who, by the way, as you know, is up for a recall. Because of his bungling of so many things, especially during COVID. A lot of people are really ticked off with him, but I think he's going to try to buy his way out of this, because listen to this. He has proposed a plan using the state's $5.2 billion in funds from congressionally approved aid packages to pay off overdue rent. So just think about that for a minute. If you're a renter and you live in California, and Governor Newsom says, hey, guess what? I'm going to pay all your rent. You're 6 months in arrears. You're 3 months in arrears. You're a year in arrears. I'm going to pay that off for you. And that's exactly the program that is being proposed. About $32 million out of $490 million in requests for rental assistance through May 31st have been covered so far, according to a California Department of Housing and Community Development report. Keith Becker, a property manager in Sonoma County, California, he said, "We should do our best to get back to the starting point where we were in, where we were in December of 2019. Anything other than that is taking advantage of the crisis." He revealed that 14 of his tenants have not paid $100,000 worth of rent. That he, by the way, as the owner, as the landlord, he has to pay, you know, assuming that those properties are mortgaged and he's got to pay the bank. You know, nobody's bailing him out. Governor Newsom says California will pay off all past due rent accumulated in the nation's most populated state because of the fallout from the coronavirus pandemic, promising to make landlords whole. And by the way, a big part of that problem were the excessive and overly stringent measures that Governor Newsom himself proposed and enforced in the great state of California that ravaged businesses, put people out of work. Left unsettled is whether California will continue to ban evictions for unpaid rent beyond June 30th, a pandemic-related order that was meant to be temporary but is proving to be difficult to undo. Gee, I wonder why. This, by the way, is being reported in Newsweek. And Cyrus will get a link to this for you so you can check it out. Federal eviction protections are also set to expire on June the 30th. California had passed its own protections that applied to more people than the federal protections did. Newsom and state legislative leaders are privately meeting regarding the protections, part of the negotiations over the state's roughly $260 billion operating budget. An extension of the eviction ban seems likely to give California more time to spend all the money to cover unpaid rent. But landlords and tenants' rights groups are arguing over how long that extension should last. Now, it's good for the landlords if they're going to finally get paid all the money that's owed them. It's good for the tenants to have that bailout. But I wonder what other things might the state be willing to spend those kinds of dollars on. The expectation for people to be up and at 'em and ready to pay rent on July the 1st is wholeheartedly unfair, said Kelly Lloyd, a 43-year-old single mother who says she hasn't worked consistently since the pandemic began in March of last year. She's a member of an advocacy group called Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment. She's supposed to pay $1,924 a month for a two-bedroom, two-bathroom rent-controlled apartment in the Crenshaw District of South L.A., but she says she's $30,000 behind after not working for most of the last year to take care of her kids. Her debt will likely be covered by the government. So this is happening. But I personally, this is the cynic in me, and I'm usually not a very cynical person, but I can't help but thinking that it's like, you know, Governor Newsom walking through the crowds, throwing fistfuls of chewing gum to everybody as a way to make them happy. And this seems to me just interestingly timed as he's being considered for recall to suddenly start buying people off. I mean, that's what it looks
like to
me.
Things that make you go,
Yeah, suddenly, hey, everybody, I'm your new favorite. I'm your new best friend because I'm going to pay your rent and whatever else I can do.
Memories are short.
They are indeed.
That's what they'll remember.
But you know what the old saying is true, Cyrus? Money talks. And if you've got Governor Newsom saying, I'm going to pay off that $2,000 back rent bill that you've got. Oh, and by the way, don't forget that when it comes time for the recall election. You know, remember me, please. It smacks of that if you ask me.
Loud and clear. Yeah. He's not even trying to hide it.
It seems blatant to me.
It seems blatant. I could be wrong. What do I know? Not much.
Yeah. I've noticed a real charm offensive on his part on Twitter. And I'm pretty sure he doesn't do his own Twitter, but his minions are doing the Twitter for him. He's always smiling and happy and thumbs up and everything's great. And yeah, I mean, you get what you pay for. I'll put it that way. So if the great state of California has an opportunity to recall a subpar governor, and they don't because they had their back rent paid for or some such thing, you get what you pay for, guys. You get what you pay for. 888-914-9149. Let's go back to the phones. Anonymous in Wisconsin, welcome to the program.
Hello. I have a question on toxic families and where the Bible stands. I'm in a situation where pretty much my whole life I've been the scapegoat. My family's always blamed everything on me ever since I was little. Mm-hmm. And my immediate family, my husband and my kids are pretty much done with it. And they think I should just stay away from them completely. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to upset my mom.
Is she part of the problem?
I'm not sure. Sometimes I think so, but then a lot of times I just think that my siblings are just jealous.
Tell you what, this is an important topic, and it deserves something more than just a 15-second response. So if you don't mind holding, I will come back to you as soon as we come back from this quick timeout, Anonymous, and let's dig into that. The number to dial, 888-914-9149 is the number, 888-914-9149. We'll be right back right after this.